Acura as well. Welcome to the show, David Krieg, a lifelong musician with a passion for many different instruments. David and I have shared a friendship for more than 5 years, and the music playing in the background is from his track Angels and Atoms. And at the end of this podcast, you can hear an extended piece of music of this track. Be sure to check out the show notes and the description below to find out more about David's work and his music. So now, this is our Curious World. When did we meet? Was it AV 11, I think it was? Maybe AV 10, 7?
No. I think it was back at AV6 or AV7. I think it was early on, because I'm trying to remember. I was thinking about this last night, and I was trying to remember who was on the bill of it. Obviously, there was the usual suspects that were there, like Max and Patrick Hennessy and everything. But you done an interview with Patrick, I remember.
I did, yeah.
So when was that? I don't know.
I think it was AV7. So we're talking...
All the AVs all just blur into one sort of big long AV.
Yes. I guess maybe if there's an audience out there wondering what AV is. AV is the Alternative View Conference, and that happens down in Hallwood House on an annual basis, where there's a lot of different free thinkers and independent researchers and journalists who come together, and they have, you know, a weekend of conferences about the world and the effect that things are having on the general population. And it's a really powerful conversation and a conference of lots of different people coming with lots of different ideas, and that's where me and you met. And it was quite nice, because you created a different kind of Tumblr atmosphere that you were able to. It was quite a serious thing. Then obviously your music came in. It was just like something completely different, and I was just like, that's what I think. That's why I came here to listen to this.
Yeah. When I spoke to Ian, the organizer of that, Ian R. Crane, and we had talked about it. And they had music in between speakers, just that kind of nice, plinky, plinky sort of new age stuff going on in the background. And I had said to him, well, why don't I play, and see somebody, think people, they can watch visually as well, because it's quite a nice thing to watch. But also, they have this, it's a bit of a new age sort of phrase, but it sort of clears the room, cleanses the room a wee bit. Yeah. There's such a lot, you know yourself, there's quite a lot of heavy subjects going on during that weekend. So it's nice to just come in and it totally resets everything again for the next person, you know. But it worked, yeah, I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, it was good fun.
Plus, I got a free conference.
Yeah, there's a lot of guests there that weekend. So, yeah. So what has life been like since then? Because I can remember you and I were talking about, you kind of, I don't know if you just got into it, I think you just had two of your pens at the time, and you were like, oh, I don't know, you're not quite going to do with this, I'm probably going to make some more. So, but now I go to your website and you're really popular, everyone's talking to you, so what happened, what's changed?
I just got my head down and started doing it. The whole handpan thing, for anybody who doesn't know, a handpan is a sort of relatively modern invention. 2001, something like that. A couple decided to put two sort of hemispheres of the steel pan, the Trinidad and Tobago steel pan, together and make this sort of UFO looking barbecue, beautiful ethereal sounding instrument. And I had saw one, or I'd heard one, back in Barcelona. And I remember following the sound through the sort of back streets of Barcelona looking for this sound, because I'm a musician, and I've been doing music for my whole life. So I couldn't pinpoint what the actual sound was that I was listening to. And I followed it through the streets until I seen it and decided that I wanted one. But yeah. In those days, you basically had to marry the people that invented its daughter to be awarded to one. It was like this sort of amazing thing that only a few people in the world had. And so I thought, well, I'm quite handy. I've got two good pair of hands and I've got a good ear. That's probably what you need to make it. So I started hammering steel. I didn't have any sort of previous metalwork experience or anything like that, or any sort of manufacturing experience at all. So I just got it wrong for about 5 years, to be honest with you. Just again, got it wrong, because there was no information on how to build them either. It was very secretive, it was very sort of clicky, and eventually things started to go right. I mean, the ones that I had when we were still really quite rough prototypes, to be honest, but they still work. That was the beauty of them. They're still, even the ones that are all kind of caved in and bashed in, and mine's looked as if they've been dragged through the streets, my sort of first ones in the back of a car. But they still, you still get the sound. That's a nice, ethereal, beautiful, sort of rounded, tarp sort of sound. And it lends itself really well to anything kind of sort of spiritual or esoteric or anything along those kind of lines. It's just a nice non. Even musicians, which is what I quite like about it, even musicians don't judge it. A lot of musicians have got this kind of snobbery where they go, oh, it's not a Fender guitar, or it's not a Rhodes piano, or that kind of thing. But that just, this just cuts through all that. And even musicians, they don't judge it, so to speak, you know. So it cuts through everything to everybody. And it doesn't matter what sort of walk of life you're from, or the colour you are, religion, anything. People just like the sound of it. And I found that brilliant. It just opened so many doors for me that were previously I couldn't get any places or do things or be in events that I wanted to be at because I had no money, so I couldn't afford to go to them. But this thing opened all these doors for me that I could go and enjoy the events, but also got to play and be part of it as well. So to ask you a question, sorry, Chris.
No, you're right. It is such an inoffensive sound that it's actually it really breaks down a lot of barriers, like you said. I don't know what the skill level is to pick up. I guess when you tap it, you get an instant sound or a note that's already in tune. That's like you don't have to go through the manual process like a guitar and having to, you know, change and put it into note. That also,
that's one of the beautiful
a beginner
things
can
pick about it is you don't need to, you can't read. There's no music, no written music for it. So you've got it, you're forced into it, just playing. So whatever comes out. And there's no, you know, there's no proper. I mean, there's wee techniques that you pick up, obviously, just to get the best sound out of every tone field. But there's no like regimented way. I always remember when I was small at school, they had you playing the piano. It was always that: sit with your back up straight, and you've got to have be able to balance a 10-pence piece on the back of your hand. You know, that kind of thing. And I always hated that. I always hated the fact that, well, it's just music. Just let me play it. I just want to play the thing and make sound. You know.
Yeah,
and that's the beauty of that.
When I was in primary school, I think it was at year five, as I called it at the time, there was the teacher says, "Oh, who wants to learn an instrument? And we have 8 violins. Want you to learn?" And I put my name forward. I was really inspired to learn the violin, and I wasn't chosen. And I really remember being so disappointed for so long. I almost resented it. That was such a barrier mentally that I kept away from music because that what happened when I was a child. It was horrible.
Yeah, music's such an important part of everyday life. You know, there's nobody that doesn't have a favourite tune or a favourite song, or there's a song that means something to them that's emotive, makes them cry or makes them happy, you know. And that's one of the things that's been difficult for me. My kids, it's obviously one's at high school and one's at primary school, and both of them, the music's been cut right back at the moment, obviously for whatever reason, but they're not getting the music, and I hate that because it's such a different part of your brain that you use for that.
Right.
You know yourself, you know, any kind of art, any kind of creative process, no matter how obscure it is, triggers that part of your brain that can't be moved by any other sort of way. Even you know, just writing poetry, just making something, even plasticine or whatever, that's an important part that kids aren't getting at the moment because of the COVID thing, but also because of cutbacks as well. That's the first thing.
Yeah, they go, well, that's not important. You, that's not part of your RRR. And it's like, it's probably more important, if anything, to understand how the room works.
The expressive freedom that comes with that kind of thing is invaluable, you know?
Absolutely. So, I've got a similar story in many ways. So, 2008, I was attending a festival. I was a speaker there at the University of Nottingham, and there was a musician there who was much like yourself. I wanted to find the sound that I was listening to. I wanted to know what it was. and it was a gentleman called Steve White who was playing a Native American flute, and he had a similar story himself. You know, when he was in America, he heard the flute playing, and he was trying to find the source of where it was because it sounded really unique. And so he forged a friendship with this particular person who was playing this flute, and then he decided that he wanted to make them. He quit his job and began making Native American flutes. And his presentation, his talk was about how a flute is more of a signature or in a village or in the teepee town, as they call them, and how you would each flute was very unique to each person. So it was almost like an audible signature when it was played. Because I'll try to do a gesture. So each flute is generally from the elbow to the tip of your finger. So even though the note is a note in tone, it actually sounds very different based on the length of it. And so they would actually spend 4 or 5 years making this naturally. So he wanted to make a process that made you could forge it in maybe an hour. So although he was selling flutes on the day, I was like, "But I'm inspired by your story. Can I come to your workshop?" And he's like, "Okay." So I actually went to his workshop in Kettering, and I actually made a Native American flute in the full size of me, and
I remember seeing that on your Facebook maybe.
Literally just maybe 3 days ago was the anniversary of when I did that.
That's maybe where I picked that.
Yeah. So that's what I did down there, and it still sounds beautiful today.
So how did you do it? What's the quick?
It's actually mathematically and kind of how the physics work are really interesting, and that's really really intriguing. So it's actually he makes it in two halves, where you would create the long channel, and then there's a small channel where your mouth blows into, which is on the inside is forged with a wax. So what happens is that he cuts these two halves on a metal cutting machine, and then you have to basically you file it down. Physically, manually, and then you carve a stop, which is on the top of it. So what happens is you blow it into the small channel, and the air is pushed upwards, and the air travels along this very small channel where the sonic on top. In my case, I have a wolf's head, and then it's pushed back into the large chamber, and then it goes along the chamber and then comes out of the holes. However, the air actually is cycling on the inside. So when you cover a hole, actually the air is kind of shooting to the left or to the right, depending on where you cover the finger. So air, the way that it's changing inside, the way that it's pushed in together, it's compressed, goes along this small chamber, and then into the larger chamber, it barrels and comes out. That fascinated me, how that worked, the process of it. And there's actually sound coming back in the holes when you release them. There's like an air pressure change. And it creates a notes are never bum, as it were. But actually, every motion of your hand covering or letting go of a hole changes the pitch of the note. It's a really they can go up or down based on how close your finger is to it. Really fascinating.
I've got a friend, and I don't know where he is in America. Just a Facebook friend, and he's Johnny Lipford, his name is. He's an American, a Native American flute player. And just amazing sounds that they get out of them, you know.
Yeah, it sounds beautiful. So natural, it feels so freeing. So I find that when I'm stressed or when I'm just like, I'll just go and play that and just be, oh, that's better. I needed that. And I guess, but I bet you're the same, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's not a day goes by that I don't do something. I'll sit with the guitar or the piano, or the hand pan, anything at all. I've got a couple of wee whistles, you know, penny whistle type things, the sort of tin whistle, that have a wee go on and again as well. So, yeah, it's like a drug, it's like a mood altering drug, you know. If you're happy, you go and you play a nice wee sort of happy sounds. If you're sad, you can sit and just feel sorry for yourself, strum the guitar in E minor, you know, for an hour. E minor! You know, it totally brings you... the other thing I like about them, especially the hand pan, I've noticed it a lot. I used to notice it with the piano, when I played the piano quite a lot, is that you get lost in it. You just suddenly forget that you're there, you're playing it, and you're in that kind of moment. It's the whole thing, I'm called Samadhi Soundscapes when I gig, and the whole thing about Samadhi is this concentration, being in this moment where the instrument and you sort of merge. You know, it's not just an instrument, it's anything you do, any kind of form of art, really. But you merge with the thing, and suddenly you forget that you're playing it. And it's quite hard to explain, but you're that happens to me all the time, though. People need to tap me on the shoulder at gigs sometimes and go, "Well, that, you know, that's been 20 minutes, mate. It's
So
time you chuck it."
that kind of reminds me, actually, just thinking about it. So, obviously, I have your name presented on screen with all your website and stuff. So, what actually is your surname? Is it Somani?
No, it's McCaig. It's just a Scottish Mac name, but when I was thinking about the whole thing,
Gonna have to
it's
send me then how it's
Samadhi.
spelt.
Thing just kept coming up and kept coming up, and it just made sense to go with it. And I'm glad I did. It's been really beneficial, although nobody can pronounce it or spell it properly. So probably nobody can find the website because they can't spell Samadhi Sanskrit because it's ridiculous. But it works for me, you know.
I was going to say, so how is that surname of yours spelt then? And I'll just add that here.
MCK.
So MCK. Is that small C?
Small C, yeah.
Yeah, a capital K, yeah?
Capital K,
Yeah.
EAGG, Edward Andrew George.
So, McKay. Okay, got you.
Looks like my keek.
Yeah. Because obviously it looks more professional if I've actually got your proper name up. I was like, is somebody his surname? I don't know.
So maybe Dave. To be honest with you, I don't really use my surname at all when I'm doing any kind of gigging whatsoever, but I don't mind it. It's not for any
No, it's
reason. I
okay.
just prefer. There's a kind of wee anonymity sort of nice thing that happens when you're just somebody soundscapes, you know? And I quite like that, but it's nothing to do with anything.
Okay.
It's my
So I was
career,
gonna say,
so feel free to
where did
spring my
that
name up.
samadhi come from? What's that in reference to?
It's a kind of yoga term, but it's sort of Sanskrit, and it means the concentration or the practice of centering yourself in a thing and being totally engulfed by the thing until you are the thing. You know, it just made perfect sense to me in there when I heard the word and what it meant. I thought, this is what I feel. So that's why we're called Samadhi Soundscapes. And the
So,
soundscapes thing just came about because I thought it is a soundscape when you're
it
doing
is, yeah.
these
When
handstands.
you hear that instrument, I mean, if you can tap it a few times, it really does create a soundscape. You know, it doesn't just, it's not just a note, it really feels like it's there's a whole wave that you can feel. And that's such a unique instrument to do that.
There's nothing else like it. When I thought my connection to music was through singing. I love singing as well. And I thought, oh, that's my connection to music. Then a piano, I know that's my connection to music. And then it was guitar, I know that's my connection to music. But I knew there was something not quite there. And when I found this instrument, this was it. I felt this was me totally connected to sound and vibration. And because the whole thing does vibrate, you know, it's when you're playing it, you can feel the actual vibration going up through you because it's a big metal sphere, empty metal sphere. So actually, whatever tone you hit, the actual frequency of that tone vibrates the metal, and you can feel it going through you. You know,
I suppose
so that's the
what.
thing that you miss maybe when you're online or if you're in a big concert hall or something like that. You don't really get that vibration unless there's a really really good setup. You know, but.
I was going to say also because you created the instrument, so that must be a different feeling as well. You obviously, when you buy a piano or you buy a guitar, you buy them off the shelf, but to make an instrument and then play it, and then you see the feedback, you see and feel the sound of it being played and the arrangement around you, that's got to feel incredible.
There's a bit of magic there, definitely. And you'll have felt it with your flute as well. There's
Yeah.
something, the fact that I don't know, is it? It's just the fact that you've done this, made this whole thing. It's got a wee voice. It sings itself. It's like giving birth. You know, I mean, that's what it's like. You're hammering away. I do everything by hand as well. I use very little sort of electricity in the process because I really enjoy the whole. I don't particularly enjoy knocking seven shades of whatever out of the metal all the time because it's really loud and it's really labouring intensive in all your joints, but. At the end of it, when you've got something that you've totally made by hand and it's singing beautifully, it's got wee voices, wee harmonies here and there, there's wee nuances all over it, different things that you didn't plan to put in it. and then you're away using that as a tool to create a living and to give a wee bit of joy to some people. It's a great feeling, absolutely brilliant feeling. And I wouldn't change it for the world, you know. I'm not made a penny, that's it. There's no money to be made in it. But I'm really, really enjoying my life through it, you know. Yeah.
So I was going to say, so could you just obviously looking at it, it's on your right hand side now, the hand pan. So what do the divots represent? What do they do to the sound?
So these, just grab it for you. Can you see it? Okay.
Yeah. I can see it fine. Yeah.
So one of the way I do it is I just pick a scale that I quite fancy having. So this is quite a. Dark scale. I quite enjoy the sort of minors because they're a wee bit more mysterious sounding. I think.
Yeah.
But I like the major scales because they're nice and happy. But I tend to spend more time on the sort of minor scales. The sort of no darker, but just got a wee sort of flavour to them. And each of these, this is an outward dimple.
Okay.
The main one in the front, and that's called the ding. And the way that works is there's a note, I think in this case it's a C sharp, I think, and along the long axis you can see there's like an oval shape.
Yeah.
Here. This goes for all the notes. The sort of bigger the oval, the lower the tone is, the lower the key is. So as you go higher, smaller. Higher up in the register, the lower or further down, and along the long axis of the oval is an octave of the original note in the middle, and along the short axis is a fifth or a seventh or a fourth or a third, whatever I decide to put in. So each note, each area has three notes in it, and they all obviously beside each other, so they all interact and start. You can hear, if I cover that, that's making that one.
Yeah.
Activate. And if you get it right, which I don't always get it right, I've got a few on the scrap pile, it coalesces and makes this beautiful sort of.
I was going to say that I can imagine my. I'm just thinking that the physics inside my head. You can imagine the sound is moving a certain direction. You can keep the flow moving around, as opposed to it stopping at a certain place. And I bet
the wave actually. I don't know if you'll be able to hear this. You hear the kind of wah wah.
Yeah.
So the wave is actually coming off each note as you hit it as well. So the waves will interact as well. So see if you're standing above it. You're getting all that in your face, and it's brilliant, you know. The other side is just a hole, and it's the sort of space inside the air is what we're talking about. We
yeah.
flip. It's called the Helmholtz resonance, and that sort of creates that deep vibrational sort of resonance that you get out of it. I don't know how this will come across. I'll play a wee minute just to give anybody that's listening a wee idea, if that's
yeah,
all right.
Okay. That's fine, yeah. I love that.
Thank you. hard here because I'm wedged between two arms of the chair. You really need a wee bit of freedom to play with it. But aye, so it's a great instrument. It's a beautiful, beautiful instrument. And then I don't know if you can see that. I put the Flower of Life on them as well.
I can see the Flower of Life, isn't it? It's the.
That just seemed to be the perfect.
It does. It's because you've got that underneath, I noticed as well. The light caught it too.
Yeah, I did both sides of it. I just engrave. I draw it out and then I engrave it before I sink it into the shell, you know.
So, what? Well, obviously, I know what happens when you play this publicly because I saw what happened generally. So, what's. Could you describe what the general reaction of people is who are around it when you're playing?
I just love it. Yeah, people just love it. And it ranges all sorts of. Really just kind of interest in it, you know, and people going, oh, and folks like probably me and you going, how does that work? The scale is zigzag as well, so it's not your traditional sort of low down here, high up there sort of thing. It's a zigzag scale, so when people are, even musicians, as I was saying, when they're watching it, they're going, how does that work? How's that sound? And a lot of people think there's something added to it, you know, because you get quite a good bit of bass out of it too.
Yeah, that's right.
It ranges from that kind of just mild interest through to people absolutely getting off their head about it, you know. It's a few moments where people have just been totally lost in it as well, and that's beautiful as well. Kids love it because they've got no sort of preconceived idea of what anything should be, you know, and they're like, oh yeah, this is great, I love this. Especially sort of faster stuff when you get into the kind of real, you know, that kind of rhythm.
Yeah, it has a really good flow and rhythm, doesn't it? So I was kind of wondering when people, I guess my question was quite leading in a bit of a way, probably unfairly. I was going to say, well, what's their emotional resonance? Do they want to come and touch it? Do they want to come and feel it? They need to feel that energy too.
Yeah. I think when you see that, I did. As soon as I saw that guy playing it, I was like, I want to go and touch that and see what things happen. Because when people do come up, they press the note like they would a keyboard or something, and obviously there's no tone in it. If you press it, you've got to let it ring. So the less you touch it, the more the membrane vibrates on it. So I invite people to do it. The only thing you need to watch is some folk are heavy-handed, you know, and it's quite a fragile instrument. It can be put out of tune easily, really easily, if you drop it or if something hits it or anything.
I was going to say, is that the case? Have you dropped it and it's changed the tone?
I have. I've had a few over the years. I remember one time I had one. Luckily, it wasn't one. It was my best one at the time, but I had one in my backpack. I was going down my stairs in the backpack. Snapped, and the handpan fell at the bottom of it, and it rolled all the way down the stairs. Oh, the time it got to the bottom, it was in two bits. It made the most beautiful sounds I've ever heard going down the stairs, but by the time it got to the bottom, that was it. It was done.
It was done.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But they're fixable. You know, if there's a wee dent in them or something like that, or they could put it out of tune. I go into schools as well. I've got another wee kind of offshoot called Sensory Soundscapes, and I'm not doing it at the moment, obviously, but you go into schools and nurseries, and I take a couple of prototypes. Well, I've learned to take a couple of prototypes that are not quite as good because the kids battle the bejesus out of them, you know. So I don't let, when I'm in the nurseries and things like that in the schools, I don't let them play my best one. I keep that for just demoing and let them hear it, and then I let them loose with mallets and everything on the other ones, you know.
So I was going to say, how long does it take to create one?
I'm about a month, to be honest with you. I should be quicker, but I just take my time and do it. And they don't always work as well. So sometimes I get to the end of the month and I finished it all, put it all together. It's quite a long process by hand. You know, there's a lot of shortcuts that you can take now with presses, you know, like hydraulic presses and hydroforming, whereas that's where you shoot water into to make the sort of hemisphere shape.
Okay.
And there's all sorts of shortcuts you can take, but there's something beautiful about making it by just doing a hammer, you know. So I'm about a month really to be doing one, and then if it doesn't work, I'm another month before I get one that does work.
I was going to say, yeah, because you've got to reset the whole process. Is there a particular kind of shape that you need to acquire? Does it need to be a certain size for it to work?
Yeah, it needs to be that exact circumference I chose. When I guessed at the start, I just chose that. It turns out that over the last sort of 2 or 3 years, there's been a wee tipping point in builders and makers throughout the world. So there's a lot more information now because so many people are trying different things and then putting it out there. So a lot of the original information has now came to light as well, which was kind of hidden to start with the original builders of them. And it turns out I'm about 4 centimetres bigger. So I just guessed it off of YouTube and Victor's, you know. I remember measuring a guy that was playing a video, measuring a guy's fingers on my laptop and going, hey, that looks as if it might be the size of my finger. So that might be the size of that tone field that, you know, you just had to guess and got it right. So mines are all sort of, mine won't fit on somebody else's jig if they were going to try and repair it or fix it or anything. And the same with other people as well. Most hand pans are about 53 centimetres, 54 centimetres. Mine's is 57 centimetres. So that in turn changes all the tone sizes as well. They need to be different sizes. So
yeah.
my E will be a different size from another manufacturer's E. Only by millimetres, you know, it'll not be much, but it'll be enough. But that's what gives it its own unique sort of original sound, as you were talking about.
That's right, yeah.
Flutes. Each one of these has got a completely original sound. You never get the same sound. Even if I built the same hand pan twice, it's going to have different wee nuances on depending on how maybe I worked the metal a wee bit more on that part when I was hammering it, you know, or I sanded it back a wee bit too much there, or burned it too much at that point, so it's going to be different nuances in it. And you never find that out until you actually don't find it out when you finish, because when you finish it all, it's still quite dull sounding, quite sort of there. And then you wait 2 weeks, and what happens is the metal all hardens up and it starts to have this blooming effect, I call it, where, as we were talking about earlier, when you hit one note, it activates another note, and the fifth on your E there will activate an A down there, you know, that kind of thing. So you never really get the same sound out of two hand pans. You get similar sounds, and there's a lot of, because there's a lot of builders now, and a lot of them are not even bothering hammering anymore. They're just going straight for the sort of production and getting everything pressed or getting it spun, and then using a lot of different tools to press dimples and things like that. And there's quite a generic hand pan sound now that's happening, that's out there, that I've noticed over the last sort of year and a half. That a lot of hand pans now sound really, really similar. It's hard to differentiate. It used to be a way to tell. When you heard that hand pan, you could tell who the maker was.
I bet, yeah.
You know, and now it's getting a wee bit more difficult to tell that now. They're using stainless steel instead of just mild steel as well, so that's a whole different kind of sound.
Yeah, I was going to say, would the steel make a huge difference? The kind of metal you're using?
Depending on the carbon content and the processes it's used. And sometimes you get a batch of steel that's just rubbish, you know. Something's happened to it and the process, it isn't optimised for acoustic properties, it's optimised steel obviously for building things, you know.
Yeah.
So there's a few processes that go into actually getting steel, and you never know. Again, that's one of the things, you can get to the end of a hand pan that you've done everything the same way that you've done another hand pan, you get to the end and it's, this doesn't sound, something's not quite right with it, and it could be the fact that the batch of steel has not been processed in the same way as your last batch, you know. So it's a bit of a gamble, but
I suppose, yeah. Because I guess if you tried different metals entirely, like would aluminium work, or even like titanium or something like that, would they create a similar kind of tone but be denser?
You can't use really anything that's a soft metal, like aluminium, or even though you can harden aluminium, it's still too soft. You don't get the resonance out of it that you would get any. Any of those kind of soft metals are pretty much useless, but stainless steel, although it's a really hard metal to work with, I've not made any of stainless steel yet, but I do plan on doing a couple in the future, because the sustain on them is amazing. Really, really long sustain. Almost too long. You know, it can be awful messy. They're hard to control the actual tones, because they're just all bleeding into each other all the time. But I've heard some really, really nice stainless steel ones as well. And there's a few processes that you can do that changes the tone of it as well. So the mild steel, you can do a process called nitriding. And there's a few ways of doing that too, but that also changes the sort of timbre of the sound as well. So yeah, there's a never-ending sort of plethora of things that can make
Because I
them all
always think
sound
when
different.
you buy a say when you buy a guitar, generally they're kind of a fixed size or fixed way of producing them, manufacturing. Like you said, it creates a kind of a standard. And while that standard is okay, that it loses its uniqueness. You know,
Aye.
when you talk about say violins, for instance, or any kind of woodwind instrument, it's like it's what kind of wood was used, what was the process of it. And that's why people love these 1970s, 1770s Stradivarius, because the wood was much denser at that time. And therefore, you get a
Yeah,
completely different sound.
because of the rainfall at that
Yeah.
time in the world or something, you know, the
Yeah.
climate made the trees that they made that out of, the grain was so close or whatever it is, I'm not very sure, but yeah, that's the difference in that, you know. I used to work in a music shop and we had this guitar at the back of me, actually a wee Taylor baby, and we had about, over the years I must have had about 15 of them come into the shop periodically and go back out again, get sold, and I played every one of them because I like the feel and the shape of them. But there was one that came in maybe about 6 or 7 years, and it was just something different about it than all the rest of them. And I ended up buying it myself and taking it home, and I thought, I'm taking this home. And it's still to this day my favourite guitar I've ever played, and I can't tell you why. I mean, it looks identical to every other wee Taylor guitar that I've ever seen or played. I mean, it sounds almost the same, but there's some sort of play, something about it that's nicer than the rest of them, and I can't tell you why. It just is, you know. So yeah, definitely, it's something to do, something to be said for a wee bit of uniqueness, isn't there?
Yeah, whether it's a resonance, maybe something's a little bit tighter, something's a bit looser somewhere, maybe the string depth, who knows, but
Yeah.
it's true, things do feel the things do feel different. When you find that one, it's like, I'm having that one, because it feels different.
Yeah.
That's incredible, really, isn't it? To
Yeah,
find that
absolutely. And
that is across, not just instruments, that,
some,
oh, sorry, you go ahead, man.
no, I was just going to say, some people search their whole life for that guitar or that, you know, something that makes them feel like that. And they don't ever find it, they don't ever get the right instrument for them, you know, and that's as you were saying, that's maybe puts a lot of people off when they're younger, like kids in schools are getting told, you know, they're getting play the glockenspiel or the recorder, and they're like, I hate music, recorder's rubbish, you know, I love the recorder, but I can understand why that would just turn people off the music. And it's the same with the violin. When you start the violin at first, any kind of a string instrument, cello or anything like that,
Yeah.
really difficult to get a beautiful sound out of it. You know, it's all scratchy, screechy, and that puts people off as well. But if you just persist with anything, any kind of creative process, you know yourself, if
Yeah.
you just persist with it, you'll get to a point where you get a wee aha moment, don't you? That it's slightly better than it was the time before, and that spurs you on to the next moment, the next moment, the next moment, and makes you constantly try to improve yourself in whatever you're doing, you know.
It's true, you know. It's like for me right now, our curious world for me is a creative process. I like the fact that I can talk to a variety of different people who come from different backgrounds, who have different stories and different expertise. But I love the fact that I'm becoming a better communicator.
Yeah.
I'm learning that process, and I feel better because I'm doing that with different people. And you're listening, and
Yeah.
you're hearing, and you're communicating. You know when to talk. You know what they're talking about. And you're listening acutely, and you know when to talk. And I think that's a really powerful skill that you have to tune. You don't learn it naturally. You do have to adapt to learn as you go. So for me, this is an entirely learned process where I'm trying to become a better communicator and educator at the same time. So this for me
Yeah,
is my
absolutely.
almost like my instrument in a way.
Yeah, no, I can get that, don't we? It's you're right. It's I'm in a band as well. Well, I was in a band. Quite luckily, I've been able to eke a wee living at it for the last sort of 20 odd years. But the whole process of being the guy at the front of your band was a big learning process for me. You know, that guy that stands up in front of a mic and talks to like a crowd full of people. You
Yeah.
know, that really isn't me, to be honest with you. But in a band, you need somebody has to do it. And that turned out I was the guy that had to do it. So it was the same thing. You learn the process of how to deal with people and how to connect with folk. or rather than just standing there and singing
Yeah.
and playing, you know. So as I that is a creative process, you're right, totally, some sort of process to connect to people, because connecting to folk is one of Joy's life's
It
one of
is.
life's joys, isn't it? I mean, too few people really connect with people. You know, a lot of folk just sail through their life just doing their job and talking to folk and answering emails, and you can tell when you speak to people that are like robots. You
Yep.
know, the answers when people answer you or talk to you, and it's just there's no life in their conversation or in their there's no thought process in it
No.
or anything. And finding that connection with people, I love that as well. That's one of the things I loved about doing the AVs, the Alternative Views conferences, is there's such a vast array of so many different types of people, to the really wonderfully strange, to the really sort of serious professional people, you know,
Yeah,
and you got to
that's
chat
true.
with everybody.
That is actually so. I got a bit of a confession to make. So when I went to that AV7, I had no idea what to expect from the people who were going there. I was going there really as a way to just to communicate, to talk to people, and to learn a little bit more, and also to listen to Ian and the folks who had something interesting to say in their presentations and so on. At the very first conversation I had, I literally could have got up and walked away. It was that terrible, and it's true. I remember sitting down at this table, and it was really nice, long armchairs, and I sat there, and I was like, I don't know anyone, I'm quite nervous, and these three women come and go, oh, hello, hello, and they join the table, and then they start telling me, and I'll never forget this, because I do use this example so often. They told me that they believe the Earth is hollow, that aliens have come here, and they somehow are communicating to satellites that they've controlled in the sky. These satellites are inflicting radiation on the Earth, and they influencing political leaders using mind control. I'm like, oh, you know, I can't do.
That's great. They've took about 10 conspiracy theories there and squeezed it
I
into the
was just
one
like,
sort of thing.
I'm so in the wrong place.
Ah, that's good. That is what I enjoyed about that, to be honest with you. I loved listening to everybody's theories on everything and what their thoughts are on. I mean, everybody's there's so much mental stuff out there. But I love listening to all that as well. I'm quite happy to listen to anybody talk about anything, and I'll take maybe wee bits out of that resonate with me, you know, or things that I think, well, maybe that could be possible or something. But there is a lot of bullshit out there, isn't there?
Yeah, it's like
There's a lot of
I
stuff.
spent time talking to Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, and I think if it wasn't for him, I don't think I would have stayed that weekend.
Is that right?
Yeah, I was. It was my first time going to as such a conference, and I
Right,
really
well,
struggled with what some of the people were saying. I was like, this isn't very grounded. I don't feel like I'm learning anything here. I mean, some of the don't get me wrong, the talkers were really good, but
yeah. No, I
and
get you. I understand
I did
that.
a workshop with Patrick. I attended that, and then that kind of inspired me to do this project, the Accurist World, is to do a kind of consistent podcast with video and audio. That at that time wasn't being done. People were only just doing a podcast on audio, and I was like, well, I've got a video set up. I'm going to do that instead, and so I do both. So people
Yeah.
on YouTube or BitChute can listen to watch. Because I watch like the Joe Rogan Experience, where literally it's a one-to-one conversation, 3 hours.
Love it, Joe Rogan. I watch loads of them. Loads of them.
And it's just like he says on there, that's for him. That's his. He's becoming a better communicator through that. I resonate with
Yeah.
that a lot. I can take
Yeah.
from that a long-form conversation where you could. It's not an interview. It's not a case. I've got 10 prepared questions. You answer them, and we're done. It's like actually, no. There's a conversation to be had, and you learn about what motivates people. Where they come from, where their understanding is, what their beliefs are, how they've got to where they are, and what they are as a person, and where they're going through in the future, their aspirations, their fears, their concerns, and that is a powerful conversation that nobody has anymore. Yet I love that kind
No.
of conversation.
Yeah, I'm with you, Kristen. Totally. We're on the same page.
Yeah.
I was listening. Interestingly, I was listening to Patrick, who's been doing the UK column
Yeah.
stuff recently. So I've been listening to him quite a lot, actually.
I just think people don't talk to each other anymore, and I don't think it's don't. But when I say I don't think they talk to each other, I don't think they talk about the right things. Everyone nowadays is talking about COVID and fear and worries, concerns. And I get that, and they come from a valid place. They're quite worried about certain things, but no one talks about subtlety or nuance anymore. No one talks about art anymore, or music, or what makes the creative process. What's people's aspirations now? People are like, I don't know where I can go at the house to get a Primark again. That's the limit of conversation. Are you going?
Yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, I agree. I love having a good conversation about. I don't know. See when you meet somebody that you can talk and go, you know. So, what do you think of the nature of reality? And then there's a conversation comes out the back of that, and then or what about physics or what about archaeology? Do you like, you know, anything at all that's no about going to Asda?
Yeah.
You pick up bananas for tomorrow. You know, I love that as well. And you're right. I always feel when I'm talking to people, I'm always kind of wondering in the back of my head. I wonder if I can get a good chat with them about something, you know.
Yeah.
Wonder if they're deeper than what they're saying here, you know, because obviously there is a level that people function on where you have to, you know, you need to go into a shop and say, can I buy this? Thank you very much. Have a nice day, or that kind of thing. And everybody plays that game where it's people are separate, but really when you get into it, you know, people are people, and no matter if you're, I always think this is, you know, no matter if you're a police guy, you know, you get that kind of, you look at policemen, you think, well, they're a policeman, or they're a bishop, or whatever it is, right? Or the shopkeeper, or the train driver, or the whatever. But when it comes to it, and they take that uniform off, or whatever it is at night, they're just a guy, or a girl,
yeah,
sitting in their slippers, the same as us. You know, and I always like, I'm the same as you. I said totally, I would like to get to that person a bit quicker than we do get to them. You know, you need to source your people that you talk to about things. I mean, I've got different friends that I do talk to about different things. Obviously, I think everybody probably does, but you've got the friends that you talk about football, they will only speak about football.
Yep.
They'll not talk to you about David Icke or you know, that's an asset of friends that you go to for that sort of thing. But
it's true, yeah. It's unusual, isn't it? That, I mean, as a kid, I can remember being that you can't talk about as a religion, politics at the table. But actually,
yeah,
they're the two things that kind of decide everything.
Yeah.
And they're the things you're not supposed to talk about. And I guess in my head, I always thought that's what I'm going to talk about. I don't
know. I mean, there's a lot of fodder there. There's a lot to talk about.
But it does get people riled up in wrong ways, and people get, you know, they die for those values.
Aye, and well, people do really get polarised over things, don't they? I mean, not just that. Anything seems to be this year because of the strains and stresses, I think, that everybody has went through. I just feel that everybody is, nobody's, it's a real generalisation, but it seems harder to find people that are willing to be open to different things, you know, different ideas. Most people are like, no, this is how it is, this is how I feel, and this is, I won't listen to how you feel, I won't listen to how you think about things, because that is not what I think about it. But what's the problem? We're listening to it.
But is that generated, say, by things like social media, where, you know, your feed is very much you, and so you're only ever seeing the kind of things that you're after, so you almost become in your own little pigeon box, your own little universe. So you're not exposed to other ideas, you're not exposed to other people, because the things that you look and click on generate your news feed, as it were, or your recommended on YouTube is generally created by what it is that you look at. So have you seen that documentary called The Social Dilemma on Netflix?
Yeah, I watched it, yeah.
Yeah, that was really good about how, and it talks about that, in fact, how they're effectively creating polarized people, because they're only ever exposed to what it is that you interact with. So if it is that you hate Donald Trump or whatever, it's because you're often only interacting with things that are about that. So you get more information about Donald Trump coming your way, or you get more information about hate crimes, or, you know, black and white violence, or Asian violence on this, and then you realise that that's all you're getting, and that's then your centric view is purely that, and you're not exposed to going, well, actually, what about this? You'd never see it, because you only ever see what it is you've interacted with, because that's their business model. They want you to touch and interact and say and click and what, Hacker, they keep your attention. And it is.
And what you should be doing is the exact opposite. You should be getting right out of your comfort zone and going to as many different. I mean, experience is everything, isn't it? Anything that you can experience that you've not experienced before is adding to your life, adding to everybody's life around about you. So the more experience you get, you find it with people that have went abroad for a wee while.
Yeah.
You know, they've come back for maybe living in Spain for 2 years or America or something like that. And they go, you know, there's a different culture happening over there. It's different for here. And it's opened my mind up a wee bit to listen to other people that are from different cultures or blah, blah, blah.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's when you expose yourself to different information, it might be that you sign in on a mobile phone or a tablet and you don't sign in using your YouTube profile, so you get a different recommended feed of information.
Mm-hmm.
And you find yourself just looking at, say, documentaries, and you find, I've never seen this before.
Yeah.
You just see different content, and I actually really enjoy doing that, just seeing different content, talking to different people, learning different ideas, and I guess I like exposing myself to that just because I want that effect. I don't want to be, I don't want to be down that just one line of thought. So,
no, that's the best way to be, isn't it? Definitely. It's, the more flavors you get, the better it is. Definitely. You know,
I don't know.
Too many people are just very, very narrow in how they go about their day.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's healthy.
No, I don't think it's very healthy at all. I think that's what's generating just discourse now. It's very polarised. Everything seems to be, I hate to use the term black and white, because we probably shouldn't use that term in that generalisation anymore, because we can't, because it's such a polarising view just to say them two words. When it's binary, you know, people are very angry about it's either this way or that way. And it's like, well, actually, no, there's a bit of a cross section there. Let's talk about the grey area. No.
Yeah, the grey area is getting painted out.
Yeah.
From either side, isn't it? You know, see that you're right. It's the white's coming on that side, the black's coming on that side, and there's very little grey. Now, it's either this or that.
Yeah.
And you're right. People need to realise that life isn't like that. Life isn't black and white. It's not on and off, ones and twos, ones and zeros. There's a whole gamut of life in the middle. You know, of that.
Yeah. Where most people are just like
experiencing.
And that's where most of the civilians are. Most people are generally like pretty chilled. They're not really on the scale of anything. They're not really like polarized by one point. They're just like, well, I don't mind, you know, or I don't really care. It doesn't bother me that much. But then you got everyone going, well, you need to choose. Well, no.
I'm not choosing.
No, I'll just stay somewhere in the middle. I mean, I think that's why music works. You know, music can speak to anyone and everyone across the entire spectrum. I think that's why music is important, and when you hear stories like the arts are being cut and when music funding is going down and no one's attending gigs anymore, you can't go to the pub and listen to like local musicians. I think it's just cutting off this communication we can have, or you know, things we enjoy together.
Yeah, there's a real dangerous thing happens when people aren't allowed to be together, you know, It's worrying over this year, you know, that people have came to see that as okay and normal. And I'm not expressing any views on whether it is right or wrong, but it's certainly not the way that you're meant to be as a human. You know, you're not meant to distance yourself from a person. One of the things that I'm missing through all this is, see, a gig, I would see 200 or 300 faces beaming, laughing, you know, smiling, hugging each other, dancing, a couple of folk would be kissing, you know, the whole gamut of human, dunk guy falling over, blah, 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 a fight starting over there. The whole gamut of human interaction was there every weekend for me, a Friday or Saturday when I was out gigging. It was brilliant. I didn't really appreciate it, to be honest, until it was taken away. And then I realised, I really miss seeing all these people's faces, or the smiles, or the happiness, or the whatever. And with that not being there for anybody, it made me think that nobody's getting that kind of sensory feedback for people. I don't know how long you go with before you go. You just shut down and go, right, okay, that's finished, that kind of stuff. You know, I'm just going to be...
Yeah, the person I live with, she's struggling with that. So she's trying to cut her hours at work because she doesn't want to go out of the house. She's getting that very much anxiety to go on the bus to go to work, and yeah, that's having a real negative effect on her mentally. And I'm just going, well, you just need to carry on with it. You need to be comfortable with it, because COVID's out there and all these kind of terrors and fear that I guess that the media push. And I mean, I think I'm quite a strong person, but it's affecting me just because it's affecting other people I know and care about. Friends and family are kind of expressing the same kind of things. They're a bit, they can't go out the house, they don't want to go shopping, or they don't. And you're going, so how are you going to get out of this? And I never understood that psychological condition, how people have anxiety about going out the house. But I'm seeing that with people I know now that didn't exist there as a psychosis. And that really concerns me. Because the people who really were struggling before, how are they now? No one knows. They don't go out the house. They don't talk to anyone.
Yeah. You hear stories all the time about people that have basically been housebound since March.
Yeah.
You know, and have not had any interaction with anybody, you know, apart from maybe a couple of messages on
internet.
Skyping, yeah. We're social animals, you know, that's what we are. We're animals that need to hug and talk and see and everything. We need to be doing that. That's fundamentally part of humanity. And with that being taken away from people, it is worrying. It's got to manifest itself in some way. And no matter how strong you are mentally, I think that there's only so much you can take this kind of suppression. And then I don't know what the answer is either.
But,
I would be happy it'd be nice to be able to just give somebody a hug again, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And so Christmas dinner literally is five webcams around the table. You know, it's just, and you're kind of wondering, wow.
Letter pickers to pass things.
Pass the Yorkshire puddings or whatever. Oh, can't. I'm too close to you. But for some people, that is a very real thing. But we were joking. Well, it's true.
There are people that are like that. I'm myself. I wouldn't be like that. I'm not.
No, maybe unless I'm bringing on. Come on, let's have a laugh. But no, it's true though. So what's Christmas like? Did you see that thing in America where they were trying to ban Thanksgiving for that very reason? It was like trending as a hashtag, no Thanksgiving, very much around the broad types. And it's like, the whole point of that is to get together with different people, you know, to bring them into your house and enjoy food and festivities. And you're going, you don't want it? Yeah. What's wrong with you?
No, and more and more people are being conditioned, however you want to say, but you see people in the street and they move out of the way of each other, you know, and it's just it's starting to be a natural thing where you don't want to be close to anybody anymore. You don't want to. You used to queue in the co-op, you know, you were right up against somebody, was right at your back, whatever you were buying. You didn't think twice about it, it was a natural thing. Now the natural thing is to avoid people and move out their way, and I don't like that, you know, and it's not good.
In all fairness, I haven't had any door-to-door salesman come round. I haven't had any German ministers knocking on the door.
I think I'd take a couple of them just to get back.
You know what? just give me a chat. Just tell me something.
Come in.
Oh, man. Because I wonder what it's actually like for the door-to-door sellers, you know, the canvassers, who that was their job. You know, I just kind of come to me. What their job is now? Are they sitting at home not getting paid because they were paid solely on commission? So I can only imagine. Those companies must be
the COVID pit of non-employment.
Yeah.
Definitely, yeah. So many people must be sitting in the house unemployed. I mean, although we're having a wee joke about it, I'm kind of lucky that I've got this and the other things that I do here and there just to bring a wee bit of money in now and again. But there must be people that whose income has completely left them.
You're right. I saw a study a few years ago that says that most people don't have enough money to cover the end of the month. So it's like, well, what's that look like for them now? Because most people are working to live. I mean, there's a guy I used to work with. He was so on the poverty line, despite the fact that he was working like 29 hours a week. So I don't imagine how he is now. So it's terrible. But yeah, this is the way of COVID, I guess. Kevin
What do you
left.
think we should do, Christian? Think we should just riot
Gavin,
and go back
just
to
do the
normal?
Swedish model, man, the Swedish model, which is, let's just run as normal. And let this become part of our general life as opposed to letting it control our life.
I would
Yeah.
agree with you there. Yeah.
Because if it's, what was it, 99.98% survival rate, that is very damn good odds.
It's pretty high.
Yeah, it's certainly higher than most other things. Like, I saw, what was it last year, more people died of tuberculosis. Something we've conquered a long time ago than have died of COVID. And it's like, well,
Yeah.
I'll take those risks.
Yeah, I think if you asked individuals to weigh it up, it's the whole see the whole your sort of civil liberties been eroded as well. This is what worries me, the whole your everything's been taken away from you. Like we've got the Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister,
Yeah.
and just how compared to how she spoke at the start of the whole crisis thing to how she speaks now. When she's given her address, it's you're not permitted. The actual phrases that she uses now are very, very
Rigid.
sinister, I think.
Yeah.
You're not permitted to travel to another area. You aren't allowed to such and such. As opposed to at the start, it was things like it'd be best if, or perhaps you could, that kind of phrase. But now
Yeah.
it's sort of completely. And that's dangerous stuff,
It is, because that once people in power have that kind of restriction on people, that's very hard to let that go. I've seen it work. My workplace has got like facial recognition cameras in there. So when you walk in the door, it tracks who you were as a person. So in my head, I go, so why would a company need to know that? So what database is that tracking it against, and for what purpose?
Yeah,
That's it.
and that the whole that whole thing, I mean, I'm very against losing all your information like that, like your DNA and anything at all that's personal to you. I think should be yours. If you don't want
Yeah.
to have a facial recognition camera taking your face, then that's that. I think you're entitled to say no. That isn't it. I don't want that. In the
Yeah.
same way with DNA, in the same way any information you've got, any data that's yours should be yours. It shouldn't be up for grabs for whatever reason. That's half the battle is you don't know what the reasons are. I mean, data, as you know, data is like the new gold,
Yeah, it's a new currency, effectively, isn't it? But
So what does that mean, your DNA? Your DNA is like the crown jewels, basically, I
yeah.
think. Once they've got your DNA. Okay, I'm going down the old conspiracy route here. I better pull it back. Pull it back.
But there's little things like, so like, is it Ancestry.co.uk and the DNA database are both owned by companies in China? And it's like, well, oh, that's a
They get
bit
bought by did Google know by somebody one of
odd.
the ancestry places
I wouldn't
started
surprise me.
using all the
And that's,
hi
I can imagine they're using obviously AI to match that up against people. And I guess it's like, how can we commoditize this later on? It's not necessarily even for now. It's a bit like, so what can we do with this? Let's get
yeah.
everyone's padding together for some future use potentially. And it's generated huge amounts of money for them. But if it's ours, should we not get a slice of that money?
Yeah, well, you can have my data if you pay me.
Yeah.
I'll decide if you can get it or not. Don't just take it, I mean, as you were saying, all the algorithms that are running for Facebook and Instagram and all the rest of it are all based on all this data that's gathered. And
Yeah.
then all the money that the billions and billions of dollars and pounds that they've made, the companies have made out of us through advertising because they can fire. They know that I like handpans, so they'll fire pictures of handpans for me to buy. They're making a lot of money out of it, but every time your data is sold on, it's diluting the pot again of how you could possibly ever retrieve that data because it's going somewhere else and then it gets spread to somewhere else. It's a pyramid thing.
Why is
Your
it?
data is here at the top, and then suddenly it's in Google, it's in Facebook, and then it's in WhatsApp, blah, 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 and then
Oh,
it just
we
gets
see
bigger
that
and
at the
bigger
beginning.
before.
Have you ever gone to a website where you obviously haven't been for a while, you haven't been there at all, and they obviously want you to agree to their cookies and they want you to agree to their data? And you obviously, okay, fine. Let's not going to accept. Let's see who's on the
Come
list. And this list is like a
on.
thousand companies long, and you're going, what the fuck? And I've gone, and then it's like, well, if you want to opt out of this, you've got to contact that company directly, and then take it off.
Yeah.
And it's like, how many companies is that? I haven't got the time.
I mean,
That's just for this website.
And that's just the one thing, I think, right? So think about what you've amassed over the last 5 years of your life online.
Yeah.
And that amount of information and data getting crunched somewhere and sent somewhere else.
It's
scary, but it's, I don't know. I think at some point we're going to pull it back in, but we'll get our sovereignty back at some point.
Well, that was actually one of the things that Theresa May did, didn't she? With the GDPR Act, she made all the websites right. No, you don't have that saved now. And that was probably one of her best things she actually did. You know, it's to basically make every website doesn't have any record other than 60 days old of who you are as a person, and essentially the ads have to start from a default position, and that affected the whole world from one country's decision. So perhaps people could themselves make that decision. I don't know.
And it's a simple idea, but it worked really well, obviously.
Yeah. Now, so we've gone through a whole like rainbow of topics, haven't we?
Well, a few, yes, I got it.
Oh man. So I guess so. Should we cycle this back to music then? And
go for it.
So what kind of music do you tend to listen to when you want to chill out? What?
Well, I found that being in the band, I'm obviously learning cover songs all the time. For it ranges from chart stuff that's out just now to all the old sort of things. Basically, whatever makes drunk folk dance is the sort of what you aim for. So over the years doing that, I found that I've steered myself away from sort of popular music, and I tend to look for things that are a wee bit more obscure. But if my go-to stuff that I've got on the radio or up at my workshop is usually classic FM, classical music, because the reason that is, it's not because I'm an aficionado of classical music, but I don't analyse it. I tend not to analyse it when I'm listening to it, so it can just kind of go through me. Whereas if I'm listening to radio and it's got tunes on that I know, I'll be going, well, where does that, well, I've got an A major there, and that's a nice production and they've done with the vocals, or I like that chord progression that they've moved, or they've done an augmented bass, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'll always analyse it in the back of my head, and it's always, that wee analytic thing's always running on me. So tend to listen to classical, and that seems to switch it off. I mean, I'm able to enjoy classical music just for the sound of the music. What I do is I play all the time. I'm playing something all the time, so I'll be sitting on the piano, or I'll be sitting in the handpan, or I'll be sitting in the guitar, so there'll be a soundtrack of some description that I'm making wherever I am, and that kind of keeps me...
I kind of mirror that quite a lot, actually. There were times I just go, I just need to have music that switches me off, but switches me on in a different way. And so it's true, it's classical FM, or it's music that is a soundscape, or it's music that is, it's music that creates an environment that allows my brain to think about, do its own thing about it, while I can concentrate on it. I hate to use the word study music, because I think study music really irritates me. But it allows my brain just to keep busy enough that I can focus on something. And I think classical does that for me, for sure.
Oh, good. You'll see as me then.
Yeah, because my brain's constantly thinking, constantly working. It's true, you hear the words, you think, and then you're hearing the story of the words, or you're hearing their intention behind it, or if you know it, you can hear that information come back to you. And it's like, just shut up. Just stop.
Yeah.
And I just want to hear it, not necessarily a melody, but something that just helps my mind just slow down. And,
I do love a good story in a song, though. See, you're like a Simon and Garfunkel or something like that. Something that's got a start, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
It's a full story. I love that. I love being drawn into a song where there's a whole world in there, and you get the whole story in it, and then it shuts at the end. There's some sort of resolves at the end. I love that.
I clicked on a video just quite randomly the other day on YouTube. And it was a vocal teacher, and she was kind of reacting to various tracks. I don't even know quite why it actually popped up, but I was like, oh, she looks like she's really enjoying that piece of music. So, and it was like "Hallowed Be Thy Name" by Iron Maiden, and she's a classical singer, and obviously she plays this song. And literally, you can see that she's never heard this kind of music before, but she studied it in a way that it was like, I can hear the vibrato, I can hear this, and this is. She has clearly, an ear orgasm. You know, you can see that she's absolutely fully invested in the song. And hears in a different way that she's never heard a song. And she says that she read the lyrics beforehand, and she says, "Oh, it's about a guy who's actually facing the gallows in the morning, about how he's literally preparing his mind for death. That his is his inevitable end, and how the song is then his march to the gallows. He has the gallows, and he dies, and how his release is at the end." And you can see that she's literally on the verge of crying, because she's never heard a song that actually has an emotive story, let alone metal or rock. And it was just like to watch that in someone actually was really compelling.
Mm-hmm. I write my own stuff as well, and I have been since I was a wee boy. And part of what I like, it's just for my own listening, it's not for any other reason, but one of the things I like is fitting a story, you know, fitting all the right. Obviously, you words need to rhyme at some point, kind of, more or less, and you need to have some sort of rhythmical amount of syllables in each sentence to match the last sentence or the last chorus or something like that. I love the process of having this one idea or something. Like, I've done one called Married in New York. My friend got married in New York years ago, and that was my first time I'd been to America. And to be honest with you, I wasn't fussed about going to New York. I was like, oh, okay, we'll go and we'll support you. Get married in Central Park.
Okay.
Oh, nice. He's now divorced. I haven't said that. But anyway, when I come back, my mind was blown with New York. When I come back, I was like, I want to fit this. I want to write a song about this whole experience, because it was amazing. And I did. I managed to fit this whole the whole feeling of what I felt when I was in New York into a song. And at the end of it, and I was like, wow, this is great. I've got this new memory now of everything that happened in New York, all put into every song, and it's neat and it's tidy and it's quite emotional and it runs nice and all that kind of stuff. So I do quite enjoy that process as well. Getting a story, getting it into the song, you know.
And
a well-crafted song, you know, when you've heard a well-crafted song as well, you know.
Yeah, you feel it, don't you? It's like, I got it. It fits right. The music's right. The timbre's right. The song is a journey, and you can finish it. It's like, oh. And then the next track on an album typically would accompany it for a reason, you know.
There's a thing that's missing.
Yeah. It's got... do you remember as a kid, some albums like War of the Worlds, where actually the whole thing was a whole orchestral piece, a story piece of the whole album, you know, 45 minutes long. There's nothing like that these days.
I mean, I'm sure I'm probably going to be the 10 millionth guy that said this on the internet, but remember putting a record on and sitting with the album cover.
Yeah.
Totally into the whole artwork and the reading of the small print. The scratches in between each track was just, you know, the blank spaces was just as important as the next track that was happening as well, you
know? Absolutely, yeah.
And that's a whole holistic bit of music enjoyment. I mean, it was an experience. You'd come in and you would... So you buy your... You go to the shop, you'd make the journey, the bus journey, you buy your record, you'd come through everything, you get it, you pay the money that you actually saved up for, cash, all the way home, you'd be looking at the record, you get home, you'd have your stereo set up, you know, your amplifier and your big speakers that you work really hard to get a good sound in, then lift it out, put it on the physical thing that I'm doing it, sit back, listen. That was an experience, you know, that whole thing all was an experience. Your favourite band that you've maybe waited, you know, you've waited a year for their album to come out, that's missing now, because people are just downloading a track here and there. Somebody told me a sad thing the other day. It was Spotify, I think it was, or iTunes. The tracks that are getting made now, the sort of pop music, whatever it is, the contemporary stuff that's getting done just now, record companies and things like that are saying, no, you can't have a long intro anymore, because people switch off unless it hits the chorus before, you know, 5 seconds worth.
Really?
So iTunes and stuff like that are all kind of pushing for songs that are fast, you know, into the chorus almost straight away. But I've noticed it with the radio as well. They cut up songs now so that they're straight into the sort of good bit of the song, you know.
And
the intros, Intros are like one of the best things. I love
Yeah,
intros.
absolutely.
What
Oh
would what would
man,
that, I mean, what would some
I
songs be without
suppose that's just
intros?
what algorithms have found out, isn't it? They've
Yeah.
discussed where people switch off. If it's a popular song, then they realize that how many people are just going, you know, no, next. Or they'll listen to 2 seconds and go, no, next. It might just be the fact that they're just trying to skip to the next song because they want to hear something they know what they want to find, as opposed to that track being wrong.
Yeah,
So the
I
instruction
feel
on this
sorry
is wrong.
for people now that I've never experienced that kind of that whole sort of physical thing, because I know music's still music, no matter what, you know, music is still music, and it's still going to affect you in the same way. But there's a whole bit missing when you're just clicking it on a phone or clicking it on a laptop, and it's just a song coming on, and then it's done, and then you're on the next one. You know, that whole thing of sitting and listening to an album and
No,
reading
you're
and
right. So I kind of have this. I'm a bit of a gamer, as it always happens since I was a son, since I was a kid. My son is also, and we kind of have the same feeling about that. You know, to physically go and buy a game, to have a physical copy, and to put it in your device to play it, is much more enriching than just downloading digitally and playing it. Because it feels almost throwaway. It's easily accessible, sure, but it feels like it can be skipped at any time, or there's no value to what it is that you've bought. Unlike
Yeah, that's it.
with things nowadays, you don't actually buy the medium anymore. So you're buying a license to play it. You don't own it. That's a big change. I mean, did you see that case with Bruce Willis and Apple? They got something.
No.
I don't know if it's actually been resolved yet. It's a couple of years ago. So he was like, so when I die, does my digital rights of the musics I've bought on iTunes, are they transferable? Can my son then use them? Are they hereditary? Or do they just disappear into the ether? And like, so Bruce Willis and like Apple are at court over this because it's like, well, I have a license, I've bought them, I've paid for them, I've paid them at retail price, but I don't own them. What's that about? So
That's right. I
they're
did hear
hammering that
something about
out.
that. I didn't realise it was Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
Hey, Chris.
Well, I don't think
That's
he's.
true. I mean,
No, do we own it? We don't know.
no, and it's the same way. I remember when my wee girl was very small. We used to go into Blockbuster Video,
Yeah.
and we'd sit, and on a Friday night we'd have like she'd be sitting pulling out, oh that one, Barbie and this and whatever it was, mermaids, whatever. And we sit on the floor, you know, she'd physically sit on the floor with about 12 wee girl sort of DVDs or videos, and then she'd pick it, and then we'd go back to the house, and that's that whole thing's missing. It's just a flick on the telly, that's it.
It's on
Yep.
Netflix or it's on Amazon. Like, there we go.
Maybe we're just old, Christy. Maybe this is the way of the world now.
You know what? Maybe it is. Maybe. I mean, I get the accessibility is easier. I guess for distribution, there's less environmental damage or whatever. There's no physical media, but it doesn't. It's not tangible anymore. I can't feel it. I
Yeah.
can't. It doesn't feel like
See, there's
anything.
no doubt it's awesome the way that you can do things now, but you're right, it's something missing. It's the same with it. I find it with Google as well. With people, instead of thinking about stuff, they'll Google something, you know, and then the answer's right there, so they know the answer to whatever it is that they want to know. But they don't. But you're not getting the back sort of story behind that answer.
Yeah.
So, for example, when I was learning about how to build a hand pan, I was looking at Trinidad and Tobago steel drum books, people that had written books about how to make the drums. In order to find out, I was just looking to find out what size to make a dimple. So that's all I wanted to know was how to what size. That's all I thought I wanted to know. But reading the books, I found like a dozen, two dozen different other things that have been good said for building these. But if I had had Google, if I had just Googled what size is a tone field, I would have got the tone field size, and I'd have been end there. And I think a lot of people do that now. They'll just go straight to an answer or something and not understand what the whole concept behind the answer is. Sort of
Oh, you
thing.
remember being at school, don't you? It's like, I don't want the answer, I want to know the working out.
Yeah. Used to hate that as
I
well.
mean,
I did
so
used
like,
to hate
fuck,
that.
you've got the fucking answer. No. But that's what they're actually trying to teach us, is that you need to understand how you got here as opposed to, well, now you're here. It's not Star Trek, you know, you need to understand the journey you took there. So stop using the transporter.
When are we getting one of them, a transporter? Come on.
Oh, I know, right?
Really, you know, can't be that much longer.
Well, you'd think not. I kind of wonder what would happen to the transport industry, you know, if goods could be shipped, you know, instantaneously. Or the thing is, would you need to transport anything if you could just materialise there?
Be a 3D sort of printer.
Yeah, 3D printer, yeah.
They've done that, haven't they? They've made molecular sort of
printers
that can do all sorts of stuff. So, I mean, within reason, that's probably coming down the line.
Yeah, they're growing like artificial meat and stuff by a similar way, and I guess that's a beginning of the process.
I saw a liver getting...
That's right, yeah.
Or a kidney.
Yes, that's it. Well, that's just crazy. They're printing new organs.
I mean, so, yeah, I mean, that, you could have your own...
Yeah.
Your own body bank, couldn't you? I suppose in 100 years.
If that technology goes that way, I mean, I can imagine that there'll be lots of disruption before that point. And I think that's what worries people more than anything. There's too many disruptions for us to get to that point. Even though it's on the cusp of actually happening, that we could provide this kind of a world of abundance, really, that would be fantastical for everyone.
It's there, isn't it?
It is.
Just, no.
We're actually almost there. Hopefully we can.
Maybe this is the final hurdle that we need to kind of get over this. So they always do say that things need to get really bad before they get better. So maybe this is the part maybe where it's getting really bad.
Hopefully so. So I was going to say, shall we draw this to a close here, maybe? Because I think I just saw the clock is 1:22. Wow.
Great, mate. Yeah, I'm delighted to have a wee chat with you, mate. And we should
do this more. Fantastic, man. Yeah.
Even off camera, off recording, we should have a wee chat. It's nice to speak to somebody that's quite open.
Yeah, cool. So I guess before we end up then, do you want to just share a bit about your details? So your web stuff, where can people find about what it is that you're into and how can they find out more about you and your pens and your music and your contact details? Could you want to share what they are?
Yeah, thanks, Christian. Just if anybody wants to get a hold of me, Facebook is probably the most prevalent thing that I'm on at the moment. Or you can go to the website, www.3w's. Samadhi Soundscapes, and if you put a link up, it'll save me spelling it.
I'll do that.
.com. and you can find out what I'm on there. But if anybody wants to get a hold of me, just ping us through Facebook. That's the best way to do it.
Yeah, cool. I was going to say, do you want to add, do you want to send me a little bit of sound and I'll add it over this towards the end so people get an idea of what that sound is like? It'd be really good.
Can do, mate, yeah. I'll do that. I'll send you every track.
Awesome, that's fantastic, man. So I'll stop recording here and. That was good fun.
That was excellent, mate. I was wondering what we were going to chat about, but there you go.
I think that whole Joe Rogan thing that allows you actually to explore a conversation as opposed to an interview with 20 questions, right, done, see you later, is I don't think that engages people anymore. It works for the news, I get that, but... because that's just bullet points, but when it comes to actually discussion, conversation, I think people want to flow. People want to go down the nuances. Like we were talking about the subtlety of music. People want to go on that journey with a discussion. And they want to feel where their points go and why they're being said. And, oh, I wish I could have said this, or I wish I could have learned a bit more about that. Well, yeah, we can do that. I like that about long-form conversation.
The world's full of sound bites. Everybody's looking for a wee sound bite. Or just the most concise way of getting any information across is deemed as the best. But you're right, it's not. Actual chat with somebody is always better.
Well, just looking at it, using the Joe Rogan show as the experiment, as the example. I mean, that has more ratings per episode than any news channel in the world. It's like 6 million views on average per episode. More people are watching that, and that's a 3-hour conversation that are people watching.
It's brilliant as well.
Yeah.
See if I'm doing any work in the house, like painting or anything like that, or anything that I've got to do in the house. I'll stick one of his on. And just have it cranked up while I'm doing stuff.
I could listen. It might not even be a subject I've ever thought about talking about or listening about, but I'm interested because that's what it is. It's like, well, it's so varied. That's the aim I go for with Our Curious One, is to be a varied conversation. And it's quite interesting how some people have reacted and said no. they don't want to do that because I'm not specifying what topic it is I want to talk about. And I'm like, well, conversations mm-hmm. don't base on topic. They'll go with the flow of a conversation. And people are like, no, I can't do that. It's quite surprising, right. Actually, yeah.
I mean, it crossed my mind last night. I was thinking, what we talk? Well, we'll obviously talk about the handbands, so, but what else we talk about? I don't know.
That's it.
Then yeah. I was thinking to myself, it's quite an interesting dude, this. I remember talking to you down at AV.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, well, like, he'll have a few things to say, it'll be interesting. Things like that. And you just kept with me.